I am going to strategy. I need to go straight back down, but just in, as a requirement within the rules, I do need to open the meeting. And I'd like to welcome all the people who are here. I should be back in the next 10 minutes, and that is the National Centre for Cleaning Production. It's your first visit to this committee. You're very welcome. We have apologies, I do know, and they are... the doctor's appointment for Honourable Khadebe, due to party commitments, PEC, Honourable Salah, Honourable Elvis is in a Labour meeting, and Honourable McIntosh will leave during proceedings to attend Home Affairs meeting. So I will be back myself in about 8 minutes. So I'm going to hand over the chair to the Honourable Kwabasa. Just as I take the adoption of the agenda, can we have someone to propose adoption of the agenda? Thank you, Honourable Van der Merwe. Seconded by? Thanks, Honourable Gil Lewis. I will be back.
Good morning, members of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, and our presenters here this morning, and members of staff. We have Mr. Dipuo Rapulu, Director, Mr. Rubon Kadali, Operations Manager, and Mr. Gashwin, I hope I'm right, Mekur, National Project Manager of the Industrial Energy Efficiency Project. You are most welcome here. Welcome. We will give you the opportunity to make an input to the committee, and then after we will engage in an interaction on the subject you are presenting to us. Thank you very much for your attendance. Over to you.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for hosting us. It's a pleasure. I'll give you a brief overview and how and how we fit in, and Ruben and Gershon will share with you some practical experience and output of what we are doing in industry and in the community at large. I am not sure if we are allowed to excuse ourselves just at tea time after the session, so we could. We have other appointments in Pretoria.
Yes. You will be excused. And may I say up front, if there is any outstanding matter that we have raised with you, you can come back to us in writing.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The National Cleaner Production Center is a program of the Department of Trade and Industry, and we are under the Unit Directorate Industrial Development, Chief Directorate Green Industry. We get our core mandate and focus from the DTI as set out in the IPEP strategy or policy document. And with the establishment of the green industry is that we use cleaner production or resource efficiency and cleaner production as an instrument to foster industrial efficiency and competitiveness so that South African industry could then be able to compete. And the idea is that these tools or methodologies become easy, low-cost methodologies to grow the economy and create employment. The existing industry, they're in twofold. Existing industry requires that we facilitate a process through which they are able to achieve, for example, the commitments on climate change mitigation and adaptation, and cleaner production becomes a tool to facilitate that. We use a number of regulatory frameworks to achieve this, and these are either market-based or industrial incentives that are available through DTI and through SARS, and we use science and innovation to facilitate the process. For example, the easiest one is we are located or we are hosted by the CSIR, and the idea initially by DTI was that we should then be able to use local knowledge system, local science development to enhance the ability for South African industry to access that skills in the country. And we are involved in a number of localization and beneficiation activities. The idea that we should help the finance sector to become more creative in making available necessary financial mechanisms for industry that wants to become more sustainable, more greener, more efficient in the way of doing business. And the other key area is this availability of skills and institutional capacity and ability for South African industry, both at a government level and at industrial level, by creating partnerships that allow to benefit from this. The priorities currently, as given in the IDD, the Industrial Development Division of the DTI, is that we should focus more on energy and resource efficiency and cleaner production methodologies and technology. We should look at renewable energy, alternative energy, and nuclear energy. We should focus on waste management strategy, integrated waste management strategies of the country. In terms of water efficiency, we're all aware of the acid mine drainage challenges that we have due to historical pollution and spillages. To also look at how industry in South Africa responds to challenges of climate change and mitigation. We then adopt the resource efficiency and cleaner production methodology to enhance competitiveness. And we undertake, to achieve this, we undertake impact assessments and strategic review to achieve a wider range of low cost. Mostly, most of the activities that we do, industries do not have to invest to see benefits out of the activities. And we look a lot at greenhouse mitigation and how industry could then survive. A few months ago, there was a challenge with the wine industry and export of the wine into Europe, saying their carbon footprint is excessive. And I mean, we are proud to say we do have wine industries in South Africa that are even exceeding the expected standards and mitigation measures because of these methodologies and techniques that are applied. I would like to then ask Ruben to give you a more practical review of what we do.
Good morning, honorable members. It's our pleasure to basically look at the context. I think you're probably aware of the declining share of manufacturing within South Africa, and that is where our focus lies. being a diversified manufacturing sector, we are involved in about 8 subsectors of the manufacturing industry. And it is the area that is labor absorbing, as you know, and drives employment creation, and therefore we have a strong alignment to the manufacturing industry. You know that it declined in terms of contribution to GDP, 16.2% in 2008 to currently at 14.6%, but according to some information sources. And the IPAP identified strong sectors such as agro-processing, automotive, chemicals, metals and textiles, as well as the clothing industry. And those are some of the industries that we have for the last 5 years been concentrating on. You're also aware of the gross value add in perpetual decline for the last 9 years, and our negative trade balance is escalating. So our focus definitely is around enhancing the competitiveness through a mechanism of looking at renewable energy, water, materials, and energy efficiency. Renewable energy through green industry is not what we basically concentrate on. It's embedded in a program that we have called the Clean Technology SME Accelerator Program, which we'll touch on later. And then there's waste management mitigation, and that potentially contributes to industrial development, localization through public procurement, economic growth, and job creation. Our programs, just to highlight there, through the resource efficiency project, we deal with 4 thematic areas: it's energy, water, waste, and materials. And on the energy side, we, through our resource efficiency generic approach, we will deal on energy matters. But we're also hosting the National Energy Efficiency Project, and that is where Gershwin will concentrate on. And I believe you want to know more about our involvement and participation in national efforts to reduce carbon emissions and also to ensure that we have a better energy consumption. On the water and waste and material side, it is part of our audit program where we involve consultants who have capacitated through international benchmark tools to conduct assessments to actually look at particular gaps within the resource efficiency area. Our key focus areas, strategic objectives, is aligned with our business focus areas. When we talk about effectively communicating the benefits and advantages of RECP and IAE, which is energy efficiency and resource efficiency, we have numerous awareness-raising workshops which are conducted at national level within industry through breakfast business, as well as having workshops conducted within companies. We've dealt with over 300 companies over the last 18 years. We also build capacity and capability in South Africa, training local experts in resource efficiency. There is a dearth of skills deficit within the industry around energy efficiency and resource efficiency. We also look at developing sustainable entrepreneurs through an internship program, which we'll touch on. Enhancing the competitiveness of priority sectors is identified through IPAP, and there we offer technical assistance basically in identifying where certain opportunities lie within the intermediate production process. We don't deal much with extraction activities, but we do deal with the production process in quite a large measure. We also facilitate implementation to ensure that there's impact as a result of our intervention, and assist with investment opportunities and linkages to the manufacturing competitiveness enhancement program and other relevant competitiveness programs. We also contribute to the shaping of relevant economic policies, especially around the economic side, not the regulatory side that much. That's more around compliance with Waste Management Act that's enforced. Then we accelerate the uptake of practices and increase of penetration of our services, particularly through demonstration projects and showcasing some success stories. We could make available to the committee some of those case studies, some of the success stories, and probably through our parliamentary office, the CSR parliamentary office, we will provide you with the source material. So resource efficiency basically is what you do more for less, and it's just that throughout the economy we're looking at the value added per unit of resource input. Whether it's that energy consumption, it's water consumption, it's become very critical that we look at resource efficiency as a critical input cost to industry. And that has been a neglected area, especially when they determine bottom line. And we are able to now refocus companies to look at areas that they've never looked at before, which is more about the green industry area. Also in an economic sense, for the purposes of our mandate, we also particularly look at mitigating environmental impacts through the whole value chain, to an extent that it also then cascades down to outsource. So in a manufacturing company, when we do energy efficiency projects, etc., it invariably also looks at the downstream suppliers, and that is how it helps to multiply the effects of energy and resource efficiency. The triple bottom line for us is important in terms of addressing the social, economic, and the environmental dimensions. Production efficiency is about optimizing productive resources, looking at the minimization of impacts, especially in waste management, and then looking at human development is the whole aspect of risk to people in enhancing the quality of life as a desired impact. Priority sectors that are aligned to IPEP, 2002 to 2006, we looked at clothing and textiles, agro-processing and chemicals, and following 2006, we added automotive, pulp and paper, metals and engineering, and mining, with tourism and built environment as considered to be quite critical sectors, which is not manufacturing. Our approach to... It's the Industrial Energy Efficiency Project. Our approach is guided by thematic focus areas, which I mentioned previously, so I won't go over that. Overcoming the barriers, if you look at the slide, it's about looking at your input-output measures in terms of what they call green productivity measures. You know, your materials and your energy together comprise about 60% of input costs. And if you can, through energy efficiency, reduce it by 5-10%, it has a direct impact on your bottom line. And Gershwin will show how many companies, big and small, have actually adopted energy efficiency as a way of business, or energy management systems as a way of business. And you've got this whole thing around, you know, where you've got the materials and energy flow coming into the company, but it also has a sink function of materials emissions. And that is where GHG becomes a problem, and your energy emissions. Why do we have resource efficiency? What's in it for manufacturing business, you may ask? Cost savings through reduced wastage of energy, improved operating efficiency of plants, better product quality and consistency, recovery of some waste materials, etc. Now, 20 years ago, I worked in the industry for about 20 years, and many of the focus areas in industrial engineering was basically around methodology and better technologies, etc. And hardly did people look at the input cost of utility costs such as energy and water, etc. Now there is now a refocus to look at that critically to reduce costs and to become more competitive. The desired impact we are looking at as a center is competitive manufacturing industries. We're looking at bottom line and returns. We're looking at a low carbon economy. We're looking at business growth and sustainability, greater market access, and job retention and job creation as the long-term impact. What we discovered is that if you start helping companies to reduce costs, you help sustainability of companies and impact on the retention of jobs, which ultimately could help with growth and invariably the creation of jobs. How do we know we have real benefits through ARECP? Here's just a slide that indicates that we visited about 303 sites, and it's not easy to access companies, when it comes to sometimes government incentive or subsidy programs, etc., there's quite a process to get companies engaged. Total assessments were 423, and total potential savings was in excess of 179 million rand. And that's a combination of SMEs and large and medium companies. And this is just quickly, you know, just to look at 9 companies, 4 medium and 5, in the areas of boilers, compressors, etc. That's energy components used in a company that will determine whether they high generators or consumers of energy efficiency. And there's been considerable savings, which we both look at from an economic perspective as well as an environmental benefit perspective. It's in materials optimization, we look at logistics, waste management, solid waste, etc. We have an internship program that promotes green productivity, and the purpose of that is to integrate talented graduates into the mainstream economy, combine the academic training with real-world experience. Unlike the normal internship program, and through applications and technology transfer, we focus on green productivity, where they're given projects to implement some of the changes and the cost-saving options. And through the program over 3 years, the program itself has generated 10 to 15 million rand in savings, and out of the 20 people placed interns, about 95% have been placed with companies, or their employability has been enhanced. That's just to show the benefits of an intern gaining industry experience, employability, resource efficiency, and bottom line savings. Gershwin will just talk about the Industrial Energy Efficiency Program.
Good morning, honorable members. I'm going to talk about Industrial Energy Efficiency Project. It's actually called the Industrial Energy Efficiency Improvement Project of South Africa. Really, it's a collaborative effort between the DTI, the Department of Energy, and the NCPC, and the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, with various foreign funders as well, from the Swiss government and from the UK government. It's a four-year project. We started in 2010 and ends in March 2014. And we really speak about it in, separately from what the NCPC has done so far. So in addition to what the NCPC has done so far, as Ruben has explained, there's also the impact of what this project has done for industry up to now. The main objective is obviously to improve energy efficiency in industry and to reduce carbon emissions and thereby also improving the competitiveness of industry. So that there are four major pillars that the project leans on. We talk about dealing with the policy framework, which is conducive to industrial energy efficiency, where we should influence. We talk about the standards that govern energy management in the country. And we've got a big drive towards capacity building within industry and within specialists that service industry. And of course, we need to communicate the successes through demonstration and the like. In the first area, which talks about supporting national policy framework around energy efficiency, industrial energy efficiency, this project was key in getting the second review of the National Energy Efficiency Strategy done, which was made available for public comment at the beginning of this year. So that is one of the key outputs that this project has helped to do. Secondly, around an energy management standard, there has been very little standards work done in South Africa around energy management. And then in 2011, ISO adopted a standard called ISO 50001, which deals with energy management within companies, and South Africa very quickly after that adopted that as a national standard. We as the project have been involved in capacitating around that standard, so in other words, if we wanted to roll out the standard to industry, You need the right kind of infrastructure and the right kind of capacity to support that, which means you need lead auditors and you need the kinds of accreditation and certification systems that are necessary. We've done that in this project. The third major area where we're getting involved in is dealing with capacitating industry professionals around energy management systems and energy systems optimization. And it's really about looking about taking a systematic approach to energy management within organizations. Usually up to, or to date, there's been a very ad hoc approach to dealing with energy within industry. What energy management system approach, along with the standard ISO 50001, SAN 50001 does, is it gives you a systematic approach, which is obviously quite beneficial. The numbers are there. I don't have to go through all the numbers, but over the last 3 years, there have been 1,800 delegates through our doors for training in the three regions, being Gauteng, KZN, and here in the Western Cape. We've capacitated 31, so far 31 qualified experts and 19 national trainers, which we are still doing. The training program is ongoing. And I think the main point there is that the project wishes to leave a legacy of national capacity around energy management systems and systems optimization. And we've already been successful in that. In 2011, we got a group of companies together that wanted to walk through a program of implementation of energy management systems with us. Those were Toyota in Durban, Galvanor Textiles, PPC, Saint-Gobain here in Cape Town, and ArcelorMittal, Saldanha Bay, and SAB, Miller in Krugersdorp. We walked them through the program, energy management system. Within the first year, massive savings had resulted in by applying low-cost and no-cost interventions, really operational change, behavior change in these massive companies. We've accumulated the savings totals there for 2 years, so 2011 and 2012 for these four companies that we've worked with. That's a cumulative total of 182 million rand saved in those four companies. And the one that stands out is obviously ArcelorMittal here in Saldanha Bay. And for mostly low-cost, no-cost intervention, they could save 170 million rand. That's verified. They were obviously very grateful because they were a company in distress 2 years ago, and this kind of impact has really energized them to a point of where they can be competitive again, where they can move forward, where they can retain jobs, and they've said as much. So they're very grateful for the kind of approach that we've brought to them, and this is really significant. We're now working with 23 other medium and large size companies out of South Africa, and already in 5 months of work with them, there's in excess of 12 million kilowatt hours, which translates to about 10 million rand worth of savings, again on the low cost, no cost side of things, really operational and behavior change. And of course, in future, they would have to invest in order to make even more significant savings. But this just shows the approach works when you have a systematic way of dealing with your energy issues within your company. We haven't neglected the SME sector, because I've spoken about large and medium-sized companies, but we haven't neglected the S part of SME. So we've done what is called an energy, we've done energy assessments or energy audits in these SMEs. We've done 124 to date over the last year and a bit, about 15 months. In those 124 SMEs across the country, and they're scattered across various sectors, as you'll see by the pie chart there, we've identified about 45 million rand worth of savings within those 124 companies. Those are just identified savings. They're obviously not realized because they require an implementation strategy in those small and medium-sized companies. But it shows you the potential, again, that lies within just the identification of opportunities for saving within those companies, which again affect bottom line and affect the other economic drivers. Yeah. Thank you. Ruben will continue.
So why are we in this business, or why are we, responding to a national context and call of IPAP in enhancing competitiveness? We believe that our ultimate aim is to achieve short-term outcomes, and that could be done through behavioral changes where companies don't have to invest. And one of that is through awareness raising, is when companies adopt the energy efficiency program, understand the benefits of energy efficiency, and already 400 companies have demonstrated that, and a lot more in the SME arena. Then you've got the capacity building is around stimulating green skills, needs, competencies in resource efficiency, and adopting a systems approach. Our audits are conducted by accredited consultants that have been trained through our system. We also look at the technical in-plant assessments that directly deals with the reduction of carbon emissions as well as cost savings in the areas of water and energy and material, considering that those are major cost impact factors. On the long-term impacts, it's become quite considerably more challenging, considering also that you cannot only attribute impact to resource efficiency. There are other interventions that companies undertake. But we believe that resource efficiency, energy efficiency, and the whole thing around reducing environmental impact has a favorable sort of impact. And we're looking at increasing our national efforts in resource efficiency. And there, I think we need to establish some kind of strategy for resource efficiency. Secondly, they need to look more closely at policy environments, when it comes to tax incentives, etc. Collaborative initiatives, we look at expansion of offerings and also dealing with clusters to create economies of scale and economies of scope. Then the whole thing around capacity building is to recognize our green occupations, and to that effect we're also looking at SACWA, where certain jobs are now looked at as critical to the green industry. We're looking at the enhancement of value addition. If you're talking about gross value add, it's about your revenue against your primary inputs of materials. If you reduce that material cost, it obviously invariably looks at margins, and that's where companies become sustainable. The whole thing around promoting diversification in ArcelorMittal and all the other big companies, it also has effect on geographic diversification. That what I do in Cape Town and I've got a business in Joburg or in Eastern Cape, it has that multiplier effect. And obviously it's looking at job retention as a precursor to job creation. As a business case quickly, we looked at just textiles. There were technical savings potential, and worldwide through the OECD countries, we measured, in the developing countries, you're looking at about 20% technical savings on energy savings efficiency versus OECD countries of 10%. The relative percentage of turnover in staff is about 23%, maintenance is 8%, energy 15%, and profit 8% this year. It means that if one can impact on that, it impacts on your turnovers in those categories. This is just basically a typical energy balance in textiles, where in certain processes it's more enduring in terms of your energy usage and consumption, and that is where our focus lies. We're very much involved in the textile industry for the last 6 years. Energy savings opportunities, as indicated by Gershwin, is about energy management systems, getting the systems right, not just replacing and investing wrongly. And it's about doing the right thing at the right time. So the conclusions around that is that cheap energy are over, as we all know it, but it's important that we look at energy systems optimization that now drives low-cost energy opportunities just through behavioral changes. That basically sums up, what we do. And Mr. Chair, we prepared to take any questions at this stage.
Thank you very much. Members, if you could raise your questions and comments, clarities and so on. Honorable Hindus and Honorable Van der Merwe.
Thank you very much. Firstly, let me say congratulations and well done for the work that you're doing. It's clear that it's certainly not the biggest program that DTI has got running, but the impact that you've had already is quite enormous in the economy. So well done. I like the fact that one of your slides had a picture of an oil refinery. I think it's probably the refinery in Durban. It looks like the refinery in Durban. Because it's one of the issues, or one of the industries that weren't dealt with in the presentation, and so I want to ask you about that, because there are two massive refineries in South Africa. Do you do any work with them, and what has the progress been, what are the results have been? But specifically, just to change focus a little bit, your program has focused quite a lot on energy efficiency, and that's absolutely right. There wasn't a lot of information on carbon emissions, and those two in particular, I would think, are probably among the worst offenders, if you can call it that. Not that they're offenders in the legal sense, but they need to achieve some improvements, and I'd like to hear what you're doing in that regard.
Okay, if I may, Honourable Member, the...
Thank you, Chair. I also, we're a committee that often agrees with each other in the opposition and in the governing party. And this time I agree with my colleague here from the DA. It's a most interesting presentation. And indeed, it's a very valuable work that I think falls under the DTI and of course the CSIR are playing its role. What I think though is that it needs to be bigger. Are you the go-to people when somebody wants to save energy? In other words, if I'm running a small foundry on the East Rand and I'm getting into trouble with energy prices, do I immediately think, who can I turn to effect some saving? Because that to me would be the ultimate outcome of your business plan, that you are the go-to people with the expertise and the research and so on. And I want to know, if you are not the go-to people, how are you going to get there? The second question is that I get very confused with all the acronyms, but that I'm Googling as I go along. The second question is, under your slide on capacitating outcomes, you've had 1,877 delegates. Once again, I would feel that we really need to up that number. There need to be people working on becoming experts in this area through small companies offering the service or whatever, and it strikes me as a role that you could play, but that needs to be a lot bigger. I also want to know, what is the, you've had 86 national workshops, what is the distribution geographically, where are these things taking place? The other area that that I think we are looking at big time is renewable energy, the winds and the solars, and how are these being transmitted to other companies? And to the training side of things. My last question or comment really is on your impact slide, the second, one was the desired outcome, and then the second one was the impact slide. You talked about the clusters. It strikes me that is a useful place to publicize and to make known the importance of the work and the importance of the savings that companies... You know, we've just recently had a whole series of public hearings on the impact of administered prices. And a lot of companies, small ones, are floundering because of the cost of electricity and so on. And it strikes me that there should be a meeting of the minds that have forgotten. Those are my questions, Chair. Thank
you. Chair, can I sneak in another one?
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you what work you do with Treasury on these issues, and specifically with regards to the carbon emissions tax that the Minister announced in his budget speech. I mean, I love your approach because essentially you go to companies and you say, without any additional cost, we can help you save money and become more competitive by doing the following things. That's a different approach than what the Minister of Finance has taken. He's saying there needs to be essentially a great cost burden which forces companies to make the necessary investments.
The stick and the carrot.
It's the carrot and the stick, exactly, except there's a very big stick and a very little carrot. So my question is how you interact with Treasury around that, because, you know, obviously I prefer the carrot approach. Thanks.
Okay, I'll hand over to the chairperson now, but before I do that, may I also raise one or two questions. Just generally speaking, given the work you have done, just how far are we in terms of reducing the gas emissions towards the target that the First Air Force has put before the country? I know it's a tall order, but you probably would be aware just how much are we slowly chipping away and getting to the target. Secondly, I do want to raise a similar question that has been raised. This, just to check, do companies just come to you voluntarily, or you have a very an aggressive strategy, marketing strategy for yourself? Because the work you are doing is absolutely important, and it can't be left to chance. It's something that you must aggressively market to the company so that a larger number choose to come to you for this work to get done. And I raise this subject because the issue of the effect of climate change, the need to save energy, and the need to use the green economy to create jobs is just so urgent. It can't be attended to at leisure. And probably linked to that question, who else is a player here besides yourself? Because if there are other players in this field that you are involved in, one would ask the question, to what extent are you collaborating with whoever else is playing in the same sport field as you are? Chairperson, just lastly, it's very good that the work that you've been doing with the companies that have collaborated with you have been saving a lot of energy. Honorable Van der Merwe has indicated to you that there has been a huge outcry about the effect of administered costs on companies, many of which are closing down as a result of that. And one needs to appreciate that kind of work we are doing, and that's why we need to hasten and expand this kind of work we're doing. But the one thing that seems to be missing in your report, quite a good report on savings on different aspects. But one thing that is missing is savings on jobs and jobs that have been created. That being one of the main objectives of EBAP and the New Growth Hub, job creation, job saving and job creation. That part seems to be missing. Thank you, Chairman.
Right. Just as I indicated earlier, this is a very critical input that we required to add to our findings. If you would respond to those questions that have arisen, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members. Just to talk about the refineries, we have tried to engage a few refineries in South Africa, specifically, I won't mention any names, but all of the large players really. The one in Cape Town, on near Milnerton, we have engaged and firstly, refineries are very good at what they do, and in many cases are very efficient in their operations already. But the refinery I speak about has approached us to help them work on their steam systems, and we've been in there, and we've done a, they've hosted a training course for us, through which we've helped them identify areas of opportunity for improvement. Which they will take on. We haven't got to a point where they have yet implemented those opportunities, but certainly they are willing to improve. The other major refinery in the Secunda Sasolburg region has also, we've worked with them on their pumping systems, on some of their pumping systems, which is also showing improvement. They will also take under advisement, obviously, how much investment they have to make in those areas. But those are the two big players that have we have worked with already, so they know us well. There's another one in which has a head office here in Cape Town, which we've spoken to, are eager to join and participate. But we haven't gotten over the bureaucratic and administrative hurdles within the organization yet. So from a refinery point of view, it's good progress. More can be done, yes. And we're hoping to do more work with them. In terms of carbon emissions, and I hope that answers the question. In terms of carbon emissions, just on the energy side, we know that it's directly linked. I mean, you've got a direct link between carbon emissions and energy savings, or carbon reduction and energy savings. And so, in our reporting, we invariably and do say that so much energy and cost has been saved through this intervention, but that results in X amount of tons of carbon dioxide equivalent that has been saved through this intervention. So we do find it and believe that it is a critical measure that we need to report back on, because it's not only an energy security issue, there is an environmental impact that we need to be considering and reporting on. So we are doing that. So that is a link, a direct link, and we will always report on that link. As I think Ruben said, we are pushing to the agenda of a low carbon economy, so we all our efforts are also reported in that context always.
Just to add to that, we've got to be tactically strategic with a small budget. We've been, from 2002 to 2012, 2002 we started with 1 million rand. We're now at 40 million rand. So from a budgetary perspective, it's very difficult to move outside of the focus areas and the sectors that have been defined through, you know, as key strategic sectors. What was indicated through Gershwin is the fact that we were able to look at, you know, the oil refineries that responded to what we are doing. So what we have to do is leverage through current programs that we have in a small way. And by that, we also invite their technical people to come on board. We train them, capacitate them. We bring international trainers that write the books on fans, teams, etc. And that excites industry. And we are able then through that to leverage opportunities, develop capability and competence rather than just build capacity. It's about competency, it's about capabilities, and that's what we're doing. With regards to the need to be bigger, save energy, are we the go-to people? I think in the domain that we're operating in, chemicals industry, clothing and textiles, key strategic sectors, they're very well aware of what we do. Our cost model does not allow us to, you know, become self-sustainable and therefore, you know, get into delivering a service for gain. So that can also become inhibiting. But if you have a program that is about, you know, awareness creation, looking at changing behaviors within industry, then you've got to come in with, you know, some of the economic policy areas of subsidies, of maybe tax incentives, etc., and then they will bite. I think also it's clear worldwide that if you're going to look through power plant generation and not through energy efficiency, you're on a hiding to nothing in the future. So it's for us to look at energy efficiency through a system, and the system is about changing. So, you know, as a brand, we're also now looking at our communications becoming part of our core business, not necessarily a support area, but to say to what extent do we now go out there, look at demonstrations, case studies, and even business breakfasts to interact with people. Our internship program also allows us to put interns, engineers that have just graduated, we take them through a month of training, capacitating, and through expert mentoring, they will implement. So these are small little ways of doing it in terms of getting to the bigger hope. In terms of the clustering aspect, too, is to look at the smaller units, develop case studies and guidelines that will help industry to do it themselves through a trained eye. And those are some of the ways that we are trying to help and do. If we look at the five-year period now, people know more about the NCPC's role than what it was previous. Also, the emphasis was on supply-side measures, capacitating, etc. What happens with the demand-led approach now that we've seen is that the budget will not allow us to really go out there. And I think that is the conversation we need to have with the DTI in terms of, you know, if you're looking at a small program and when, you know, there is now demand for its services, it needs to grow.
In terms of the currently in the country, in terms of resource efficiency and cleaner production, we are the key focus area. There's no one else who does the kind of work. But if you're looking at elements, for example, on energy, you look at specifically electrical energy. Eskom has a program. DST has a Sanadi research area. But in terms of practical implementation and industry level, we are the key focus. So we can claim in most areas of our activities that there's no one else who could do that. And that also touches on the reason why it's only 1,800 people trained, because there was no training materials or unit standards or accredited courses available in the country until this program started. So we had to develop that, put it into pilot testing, whether it meets SAQA standards in terms of South African education regulatory framework. And the 1,800 that we present are the ones that have gone through training programs that fit with the standards and quality of education in South Africa. And the ones that are trained experts, I can say that they are also recognized as expertise in North America, Europe, and most parts of Asia, because those standards at that level of training. So I think with the standards now there, the number will go up. We have put together a plan to do that. The work on renewables and alternatives, it's a bit slow because the national policy framework as well needs to then also become more easier understandable, and we have started doing some work with the DTI on how best we could get involved in helping, especially the massive new industry that is developing in that area. We're looking at clusters both from an industry clustering point of view, especially on the question of what about the chemical industry or the chemical sector. If you cluster them together, it's easy with a limited budget to say copy and paste some of the common benefits within between industries. Then you don't have to invest a lot, because if it's a pump or it's a heater or it's a fan, it will be the same everywhere else. So you start clustering those benefits and impacts across the sectors. We have done some work with Treasury in the two areas, specifically on energy efficiency incentives, on the MSEP, Manufacturing Enhancement Competitiveness Scheme. If a company goes through our process, amazingly compared to the other incentive schemes in the DTI, MSEP becomes 70 to 80% accessible to them. And we are seeing a high uptake of MSEP because of that. So there is a lot of work that we do interacting with other government departments that influences the incentive schemes inside the DTI. We also, in terms of carbon emission and greenhouse gas emission, you asked about our route towards achieving the national targets in 2015 or 2020. If we do this in a more integrated and make sure that the impact on energy efficiency specifically is greater, we can dent the targets fairly well. But there, of course, there are other activities that need to be done by other institutions of government and government departments. But I need to remind the House that once Medupi and all the other new power plants comes on board, in terms of the current trajectory, we're going to increase our output of carbon emission, because that will be necessary for those plants to come on board. So there's currently a good, we're doing very well, but when the plants come on board between the next 2-3 years, we will exceed our target and we will look like we're not going to achieve the target. But in the 5 years, the assumption and technical expertise is that it will start going back to normalization, and I think we will be able to achieve the target as given or as instructed by the president. There are very few players. Most of the players or the experts, let me call them experts, in the country that are South African citizens have gone through our training program. So, and we have a challenge that industry has asked us to multiply that to grow the number of expertise. So we are aware of who they are and where they are found across the country in all the major manufacturing hubs like Gauteng, Western Cape, Eastern Cape, and KZN. They are there. We have made sure there's that capacity. But there's also a growing number of foreign experts that are seeing this as a new area of business, and they are coming into the country, and most of them come through us, and some of them are coming in and adding value because they either come in and because of BEE they partner with South African, or they come into the country and develop their offices. Then the offices become international office based in South Africa. So we have a few in Cape Town, for example, that they come from Netherlands or Sweden, but they now operate fully in South Africa, and they are servicing other continents or other countries as well. And that the work that we are doing, there are about 12 NCPCs in Africa, and all of them look at South Africa or at us for the leadership, for the guidance, because half of the companies that are trading inside the continent are based in South Africa, and they will tell them that we already have a relationship with South Africa. So there's also beginning to be that capacity going on. We have not been able to, except the last year or two, to show positive feedback on employment creation or job retention or job creation. And we're hoping that now with us being able to say this is the exact amount in rents this company has saved, we will then be able to use that to determine how much employment ability they could create or they could retain. One of the reasons was green economy was seen initially as a nice to do, and now with the students, the 20 that he spoke about, it was amazing that within 6 months the companies were telling us we are taking the students in, and they got employed because they were seeing the value. And the one other challenge is that it's becoming very difficult also to keep our own staff. We have about 37 staff members, and in the last 3 months, four were the chemical companies, the big ones, even Eskom. They literally come into the office and say, we are going to poach that one and that one and that one, who we have assigned to them to help them. So we're now sitting at a point where we now need to fast-track the skills development and the training for our own ability to deliver, but also because of the demand in the market right now. So that we can now give you figures and say we have trained so many and so many are employed. We're also getting, for example, there was one student that was offered employment by an Australian company, and the last time we met, says, no, I've relocated to Australia, I'm working there, thanks to your skill. There's one who's, I think, is in Gabon or somewhere in West Africa, and we just, before we even finished training, the company was already taking. We have now placed 16 in the last 2 months, and the previous group that we had is already now in demand. Four of the companies are asking if they could also then take over that. The students, one of the reasons we really think it's going to become a critical thing to have the students is specifically on SMMEs or the smaller companies. Mm-hmm. They do not have the capacity nor the time. You'd find, for example, one automotive supplier company that supplies one of the big German companies, they were losing because the CEO, who's the owner of the company, is also the marketing manager, marketing director, is also the chief finance officer, is also the plant manager. And by placing a student to take over, for example, the plant and operation of the company, you release him to focus on business development issues. And we're starting to find that these SMMEs are seeing that as a value add. And that is why initially we couldn't show the financial value of SMME because they were not investing, because they don't have the capacity to do that. So it becomes very interesting for us. We're taking the student who just graduated with a BSc or with an MSc, doesn't have skills, industry says we need the skill, 3 years experience. So we take that, we train, and we put in that company and take the risk. And the company decides, no, this student is not going anymore. So that look at the capacity of that student to deliver changes automatically when we do that. And the CSR, this is where the CSR is playing a very critical role, because the technology and the methodologies are sitting as intellectual property of government through the CSR, and it becomes easy for us to roll out those programs.
Yeah, I think we should have a law against poaching, rhino poaching. I think we should extend it to human poaching.
I think you make a very good point, Honourable Mandela. I just wanted to raise one tiny issue, and if you would just put us in the picture and then add to this in writing.
Okay.
I don't think you've responded or it hasn't been raised. I spoke to the Secretary. You raised under manufacturing sector in South Africa when you're talking about the declining share. Under number 5.5, you say value add has been in a perpetual decline for the last 9 years. Value addition. And then you carry on. Unfortunately, I wasn't here for the rest. I'll have to study it. Can you just comment on that? And then give it to us in a contextualized manner in writing.
Yeah. Good. I think through usual news or sources, it does indicate a decline, obviously, because of the rise in input around material cost. I think we get importers of material, and therefore it becomes a problem with dealing with your competitive prices, and invariably with your energy going up and your materials cost going up, is that where your value add becomes a problem. It's your revenues and your materials cost. The differential between that is where it's your value addition. And many companies feel the pinch because of bottom line. And secondly, we must understand that there are many shareholders that are not really interested in the sectors. It's more about shareholder value. And when you talk about shareholder value and that impact, that they will flight their capital. So retain that is to say, let's look at those input materials. Let's look at those input costs, the energy costs, etc. It's escalating. So I think the value addition is very important to stem that tide. Secondly, it's also around ensuring that you look at the critical manufacturing, labor-absorbing sectors. And I think it's very difficult for us to talk about job creation without talking about job retention. Job retention is when you create sustainability around, you know, being the best that you can be in that environment and competitive. When that happens, you get the opportunity to grow. When you grow, you start looking at job creation.
Sure.
We must also understand that many of the big companies we work with have a lot of downstream suppliers. So whilst they have direct job creation, there's also the indirect spin-offs. If you look at textiles under siege, you look at you know, chemicals particularly, etc., with compliance issues, etc. When you start raising value around how you deal with, you know, your process controls, etc., it enables us to help companies to identify other opportunities rather than just labor productivity, labor productivity. I think there's a great focus on labor productivity, and we've got great skills with people, but they become the pressure point when it comes to reducing or increasing your margin. So what you're saying is take that focus away and you start looking at the other input cost that matters most. And I think it's important that even in South Africa, we take this more seriously around resource efficiency. If you look at Europe, they've got flagship programs. You've got strategies all over the country. What we have an advantage of, De Boer is the chairperson of the African Roundtable on Resource Efficiency, which again gives us access into the larger markets. He's also on the RECPnet, and that is where we have a knowledge management network that allows us to gain insights into developed countries' work on energy efficiency and water. And those are things that we are now trying to look at. I think the question around geographic distribution in South Africa needs to be attended to. We're fortunate to sit with the CSR, who has about 4 campuses in South Africa. And we are able to use the institutional infrastructure, which is highly governance-oriented, to be able to use it as a platform. So in Durban, with a big clothing and textile, chemical industry, automotive industry, we are present there, so we can work in those areas. In Cape Town, we are very significant. We've got 8 people here. And then in Pretoria, the Gauteng northern region, we've got a 20 headcount within that unit, which is with the CSR's bigger unit. And we're also able to work with the CSR around some of the research work they have been doing and gain that kind of leverage. So I think there's definitely an opportunity to look more seriously around resource efficiency, sustainable consumption, and production. What is happening at government level is it sits with 4 ministries. You've got the green economy and economic development, you've got green industries and your renewables in the DTI, you've got sustainable consumption production in the DIA, and in the DOE energy efficiency. It's how do we integrate that around critical platforms and fund it correctly to be able to leverage the opportunities that we identify.
Thank you. And is that Mr. Ruben
Kadali?
Thank you very much. And the director then was Mr. Rapulu.
Yes.
Thank you. As I said, I regret not being here in for the entire presentation. I did raise this with the staff that we needed to invite you once I read one of your articles in this regard as a critical component of looking at, you know, growing this sector, but at the same time, faced with the constraints we have, how do we save, you know, or conserve in this particular, and you have come, you have filled, I think, a very essential gap in this particular area. We would appreciate there are certain points you've made, which you do need to expand on in writing. We are in the middle of completing our report on the colloquium. We've got a first draft, but we need to capture this within that draft. So if you're able within the, by say next Tuesday or so, to give us this back in writing, we can bring it into the committee on Wednesday. Is that, would you agree on that then? But I must thank you very, very much, and I'm only sorry that we haven't had the opportunity of engaging you in previous years. So thank you very much for being here, but I'm sure it's because you're in so many different areas, and some of us may have lost sight of the unit itself. Thank you for your attendance. Thank you very much. You're welcome to stay for a while, but what I thought, members, what we would do, seeing as the AG is here, is to immediately engage with the AG. Are members happy about that? Has the tea arrived?
Yes,
all right, let's have a quick tea break then.
We forget that we are going to be there at the end. Yeah.
Can't fit them in. and we thought it was very important that we try and accommodate them in time. They've had the chance, I imagine, by now, to have had an opportunity to review some of the strategic plans. Is that right, Mr.
Chairperson, because of the timing of the information that we received from the DTI, we're not yet complete for that exercise while we're at this point of time. So we have this point of time. But as soon as we have got the information, we will not be available.
Because what we probably won't have another opportunity, so that information will have to come back to us in writing. So if you would simply share with us the key parameters that would assist us in being able to interrogate and scrutinize these strategic reports, I'm sure it would be very helpful. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members. Before I do that, can I just also introduce this committee to our flagship report? This is the latest general report of the Auditor General on the national outcomes of national and provincial departments. It's the first time that we actually, in one report, have got a summary of national and all nine provinces. In this report, if you go to page 403, there's a summary there of the DTI portfolio. It's a very handy summary that will take you through all the key aspects of your whole portfolio. There's even some information on the so-called Section 4.3 entities that we do not necessarily audit. So, for instance, if you want to have a quick feeling of what is the state of affairs when you look at predetermined objectives, you can just look at page 406. There's a big table there. I'll put it up for you. It looks something like this.
And when are you sending that to us?
Chairperson, we started to release it last week, Wednesday. I think currently our challenge is to get enough copies here in Cape Town. I actually struggled to lay my hands on this copy, so we are aware that it is an urgent need, so we are working hard on getting it resolved. As far as I know, we can just check. I saw my colleagues putting for each chairperson of a committee one in a personal envelope. So I'm wondering that we can check with Winston what happened to chairpersons, because we started off by at least distributing to the chairpersons. Because it's important that you've got access to this, because it's got some very handy information in it for you. So in a glance, you can quickly see what is the status of predetermined objectives in the whole portfolio for the 11-12 year. So a very handy, and then please don't miss it when you get your copy. At the back, hidden here in black, is a nice booklet that can assist you, tells you about our audit process, how do we audit, why do we do certain things. It explains to you all our audit terminology. It explains to you how we see the accountability chain, who's got what responsibility. We quote a lot of legislation here, which we believe should be able to help you in your oversight function. And we will follow up on what is the process with at least a chairperson receiving a copy. Chairperson, then I think the main focus of today's discussion is to assist the committee. It's now the time that the strategic plans have been completed, and it's the time that the committee looks at the strategic plans, and then very soon you will also be looking at the budget. Now, the two actually go hand in hand, and as I go through my presentation, I will explain to you the importance of looking at both of them, and I also try to be very practical in my discussion. Yes, we do not have the final results yet for the 13-14 project, but we will get back to Jefferson as soon as we can. I think for today's purposes, I'm not going to go through all the slides, because I think we all understand now that the annual performance information it's prescribed by legislation, needs to be done by all entities in government. We need to audit it as the Auditor General. We need to ultimately, the idea is that we would also be expressing an opinion in the audit report itself. Currently, we only report factually on our findings in the audit report, but we are expressing an opinion in the management report. So management, at this point in time, know if we would have expressed an opinion in the audit report, what that opinion would have been. So it's a very good indicator that should the Auditor General decide it's now time to actually report on it formally in the audit report, that entities would have had enough opportunity to be well well prepared for that. I would like to start off with a slide. Unfortunately, they're not numbered, but it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Slide 8 looks something like this. And then mine is. Let me get one with numbers. Let me get. Yeah, legislative requirements. Mm-hmm. So just to briefly go to the legislative requirements again, and there's some guidance in there that would assist the committee in its oversight function. Now, the first pieces of legislation just deals with the Public Audit Act, which actually requires the Auditor General to audit and report on performance information. And I've indicated to you how we currently do it, that we express the opinion in the management report, but we report factually on certain findings in the audit report. Then, of course, there's the PFMA, which got a specific requirement, which requires all entities to report on its performance against predetermined objectives. That's on the next set of slides. And then the trade regulations give some more guidance. Trade regulation 5, more specific, gives some more guidance. But it's also interesting to note that there's in the public service regulations, also a section that actually deals with the strategic planning section. And it's got very specific requirements of what should be contained in a strategic plan of an entity. And the researchers can help you to make copies available for you of the detail of that. What is required in this public service regulation ties in very nicely with what is also required in terms of the trade regulation. And very interesting, one of the requirements is, for instance, that the strategic plan should describe the goals, targets to be attained on the medium term. Set out the program of attaining those goals and targets. And then, very important, specify the information systems that would enable the executing authority to monitor the progress made towards achieving those goals, targets, and core objectives. Now, what we tend to find is in the audit process, when there's findings normally on verifying the actual achievement, it actually goes back to a system that there was not an adequate system for monitoring and providing this information. And as we can see, it's actually a requirement of the public service regulations that entity should establish that. I'm going to focus a lot on the goals and the targets, because that is, to a large extent, where the focus of this committee is going to be through the review phase now. And then, very important, at the bottom, you'll see there's two frameworks that have been issued by National Treasury. The first framework was a very brief framework, which was issued in May 2007, and is now a much more comprehensive framework. It's a very thick framework that has now been issued in August 2010, and is applicable from the 1st of April 2012. It's a much more comprehensive framework, and it could help members to maybe just read through that framework to get a detailed understanding. I'm not going to deal with the next slide. It basically just describes the process that we followed up to now. It started way back in 2004-2005, where we did very basic work on performance information, and we're now at the point where we actually expressing an opinion in the management report. I want to focus sometime on the next slide, the one that's got this diagram. This is the one that will help you a lot in your oversight function. The whole cycle, it's a cycle that literally goes over a 12-month period and then repeats itself, and I will also indicate to you where we are currently. Parliament, provincial legislators and municipal councils, they are responsible for oversight, and this committee is assisting Parliament in the oversight. Policy gets made ultimately by government, and in the context of South Africa, you will find it in the 12 national outcomes. For instance, you will find it that entities will have to look at the national development plan. Entities will have to look at their own legislation. Entities should also, to a certain extent, maybe focus on what is contained in the State of the Nation address every year. From that information, an entity should now actually go and develop its strategic plan. So when you look at the strategic plan, and it's, for instance, an entity that is governed by legislation, one should make sure that the entity is aligned to what is in the key legislation. Sometimes difficult to do that, but there should be alignment with the key legislation. Entities should not be focusing on things which is not allowed in terms of legislation. You should be able to see the 12 outcomes or whatever outcome is relevant to that institution. So they should be able to say to you, outcomes 3, 5, and 7, those are the outcomes which impact on us, and this is where we have catered for them in our strategic plan to ensure that we will actually contribute towards that outcome. So you cannot let that go out of sight. Then, of course, if it's a capital-intensive entity, the National Development Plan, of course, could also have a significant role to play in that. So, ultimately, an entity must now develop a strategic plan and an annual performance plan. Now, very important is that there should be a budget linked to that. If you don't have the budget to execute the approved strategy, then you will land yourself in a situation where you will sit at year end with a very low percentage of your actual objectives achieved. Sometimes what happens is that already at the beginning of the financial year there's misalignment, maybe because of budget cuts. An entity's initial budget was cut significantly, and that could have an impact then. Unless the strategic plan is then adjusted. So if you then move to the right-hand side there, you'll see that we say there that specific performance indicators should be determined, and that should be included in the operational plan, which should be linked to the budget. This is where we typically find our challenge. We in our environment, we talk about usefulness, and you will see in our, wherever we report, we talk about usefulness. If we look at the compliance side, normally there's not much problems anymore with compliance side. Entities do develop their strategic plans. They normally do submit them in time. So we tend to not find a lot of problems in that area. But the problems are with usefulness. And if you look at usefulness, we refer to what we call the SMART criteria. Your goals and targets should be specific, should be measurable, should be attainable, it should be time-bound. And this is where we recommend there should be some focus from oversight committees when you look at the strategic plan. You should be able to, if you look at what is contained in that plan, to have a very good understanding of what is it that they want to achieve. How are they going to measure that? If it's written in a way that an oversight committee have difficulty in understanding what is it that they will really be doing and how would they be measuring on the end of the day, then it's an indicator that measure does not comply with the SMART principle. So what we tend to find is that if it's not set up right in the strategic plan and in the annual performance plan, that's when you sit with the situation that once we come for the audit, that there tends to be findings even at that level yet. And that's why it's important that there should be a lot of focus in getting the annual strategic plan and the performance plan set up in such a manner that it complies with those key principles. Once the strategic plan has then been approved and tabled, it's very important that the correct resources are then allocated to execute it. And then starts the implementation and in-year monitoring. And this is where the oversight committees once again has got an important role to play. There should be a quarterly reporting process. It's actually a requirement of the legislation that there should be a quarterly reporting process. Ideally, those quarterly reports should also be submitted to portfolio committees for review. And we recommend that the focus of portfolio committees during the review phase is to focus on, first of all, how well is an entity doing in terms of its achievement. Are they going to underachieve? If so, what is the reasons for that? What action plans are put in place to address those underachievements? You would have noted that in our audit reports of the 11-12 financial year, we actually had a section in the audit report where if an entity did not achieve more than 20% of its objectives, we actually highlighted in the audit report to say this entity only achieved 40% of its objectives. And it's important to focus on that because you can have a situation where an entity has achieved 40% of its objectives but used 100% of the budget. Then there's something that needs to be focused on. It also, in many areas, have got an impact on service delivery because those objectives were set there for a very specific purpose. If they're not achieved, then something was left behind. Somewhere, an entity might not have contributed what it was initially set out to contribute. So in-year monitoring, very important. We believe that the portfolio committees can play an important role in trying to ensure that entities actually do much better in achieving their set targets. And you will see we actually say monitor and take corrective action. Then comes the year-end reporting. That's the cycle that entities will also be going in now. End of March is the end of the financial year, so they will then start to compile their final performance report, which they will be submitting to us for auditing together with their financial statements. Typically, the findings that we have in this area is still that entities cannot substantiate their actual performance. And this is once again something for which they must put systems and processes in place throughout the year. And that's why when I started off, I referred you to the committee to also this specific section in the public service regulation, which says there must be a system. And when we talk about a system, it does not need to be a computerized system. It can also be a manual system. But it should be a system which is reliable. It should be backed up by policies. Everyone should know what is it that I need to do. When do I need to do it? In what format do I need to keep the information? Then first of all, management should be reviewing that information to make sure it's accurate and complete. And then internal audit have got a significant role to play also in verifying the information, report to management and to the audit committee. Audit committee has got a oversight function. And then of course, once again, the portfolio committees also have got an oversight function. So if the focus is on in ensuring that entities can actually prove their actual achievements, then there shouldn't be a cause for concern. The other area which still creates a bit of concern is that entities tend to report on areas which were not included in the initial strategic plan. You should be reporting on what has been included in your strategic plan. You shouldn't actually report on anything else. In fact, you shouldn't have focused on anything else throughout the year. So this explains for us the whole cycle, and where we are currently in the cycle is actually at two different places. On the one hand, we are on the right-hand side, where it's now the indicators have been set, the budgets have been determined. It's now a review of that, and then on the other hand, we're also moving towards the left-hand side, in that end of the financial year, and entities will have to actually prepare those annual performance plans, annual performance reports. The next slide just gives you a basic idea of what we focus on during the audit, but we believe that this is the very same area that any oversight committee can also focus on. The first area is compliance with the regulatory requirements, and that basically deals with, does an entity have a strategic plan as required by the legislation that I've quoted before? Have they submitted it in time? Currently, the Treasury regulation says that the strategic plan must be submitted 10 days before the discussion of the budget vote. That's the current requirement. And then very important requirement of legislation is that together with your financial statements, you must submit your annual performance report, and that needs to be ultimately included in your annual report, which is tabled in Parliament. And then we get to the area of usefulness, which I've discussed, and the focus should be there on presentation. The way it's presented, does it... by lack of a word, does it talk to you? Does it make sense? Is it measurable? That is the key. That is the key thing. If I can use an example in your environment, and I'm not saying it's an actual example, if there's a target set or an objective set of to increase trade, just to say to increase trade is very vague. It's not measurable. How will you go and measure in the end of the day? So you need to link it to something. You need to say, we want to increase trade in this area by 2% by 2014. You know, then it becomes measurable. It needs to be relevant. It needs to talk to your specific environment. It needs to talk to your specific outcomes that you are responsible, and it needs to talk to... any other requirement in terms of specific legislation in your environment. Very important is consistency. You need to be able to see the link between what has been approved in the strategic plan and what is ultimately being reported in the annual performance plan. So as part of the audit process, what we literally do is we take the strategic plan and we put it on one side, and we take the annual performance report and put it on the other side, and we literally check it on a line-by-line basis to make sure that what is included in the strategic plan is actually what is being reported on. Then the last part is the reliability part, and this is what we do during the final audit process, which we will now start with from April onwards, is to determine if the actual achievement that has been reported there, is it valid, is it accurate, and is it complete. And this is where management needs to give us the information to enable us to execute those actual procedures. The next slide, I just want to focus on the first two areas. The one, once again, I can't overemphasize it, that entities need to have proper systems for managing performance information. But then very important that as we as auditors focus on measurability, relevant presentation and consistency, we believe that oversight committees should also be focusing on those specific areas. I've already indicated to you what we report where, and I've actually discussed with you the last slide I've covered for you during my discussion. This is just to assist the committee if you at some point in time would like to reflect on what should we be focusing on usefulness. You can see there on slide 15, we give you the key areas that it must be well defined, it must be verifiable, it must comply with the SMART criteria. The same for the ability, this is just to really help the committee. And then once again, just the emphasis there that our approach was for the 11-12 year to highlight to in our audit report if there was significant underachievement of the planned target. Slide 18 is very important. Here we just highlight still some of the root causes which leads to actual findings on predetermined objectives. And it mainly relates to a lack of control to ensure adequate oversight over the performance information. If the process followed now to actually prepare and present a strategic plan was not a properly controlled process, an entity will sit in a situation where there will be a lot of findings on the basis of that strategic plan or annual performance plan. And this can only be corrected a year from now when they prepare the following year. So that's why it was very important that during the preparation phase now, entities should have focused on our audit findings from the previous year. We recommended to all our auditees that they should actually have action plans to assist them in addressing the previous year's audit findings. Very important, we should never underestimate the role of internal audit in this. Internal audit should have a look at the systems and the processes, at the policies, and in the in-year monitoring. Internal audits should timeously highlight if there are any significant areas of concern in this whole cycle. And then still one of the root causes, major root causes, is that we do not get the supporting documentation to verify the actual achievement. If we look at recommendations, we feel that leadership should exercise a responsibility regarding this whole process. And as I said, action plans should be developed, should be executed, and then still there's some room for training and development on this area. We start to see now that some of the entities are appointing people in the strategic unit which really understands the principles, and you will see that for those entities, they will be doing good when it comes to the strategic plans and actually managing the whole process. But in some areas, there's still some training that needs to be done. Very important, there must be standard procedures. It must be documented so that if someone is new in the organization, he would understand what his role is. In this cycle, actually most of your senior management is involved in it. So you cannot have a section head saying, I'm responsible for this program, but it's the head of strategy's responsibility to make sure that we report accurately. It's actually each section head's responsibility to make sure that he knows what is it that he needs to do, what is the information that he needs to feed, in what format must he actually give it to the head of strategy, who's just the person who collates this information and ultimately puts it in the actual performance report. Clearly defined roles and responsibilities, this is what I was referring to now. And then we believe that very important in this cycle, and also to make sure that you achieve your objectives, is to make sure that there's alignment between individual performance contract and the strategic plan and the annual performance plan. That will force people to work to execute what is required for that specific year. And then ultimately there will automatically be consequences if the person do not contribute to achieving the overall objectives of the entity. We believe that audit committee should, if you look at slide 21, we believe that audit committee should focus on the quarterly reporting, and as I've also indicated, it would be very, very important if portfolio committees can also focus on quarterly reporting. Interrogate those reports, try and make sure that it's not just someone's view at that point in time of where they are in terms of the achievements, but that they can actually back it up with substantive information even throughout a year. Then we are saying that performance information is such a key area, it should form part of any entity's normal day-to-day risk management processes. So when a risk assessment is done an entity should also say, what is my risk that I will not be achieving my objectives? What is my risk that I will not be accurately reporting on my achievements? What is my risk that my strategic plan and my annual performance plan will actually not be complying with a specific requirement? Chairperson, I will gladly take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Manfira, and your colleagues. Members, comments, questions? Thanks. I see there are no comments. And
well, I think
yes, Honourable Van der Merwe.
Well, I suppose the question, I mean, this is very interesting from the perspective of helping us to understand what we must be looking for, essentially, and what departments are required to do. But the question is, when are we going to get the report, the audit, you know? The strategic plans are now complete, and they were a little bit late, were they? So we need to know when we're going to be able to see the thing.
Because as I understand, the audit reports will only come in July, is it, after the fourth quarter? August, but what we're faced with here are the new strat plans and how we should examine the new strat plans. But I think the point you have made, Honourable Van der Merwe, we need to take with us as well to the annual reports when we finally get them, and the next, of course, Auditor General, the actual statement that we do get. But on the value, per se, of what you've just given us, I think the Honourable Hill Lewis wishes to comment or raise a question.
Two potential problems that I kind of perceive in the system. Doesn't the system incentivize departments to under-promise? To under-promise. Because if they over-promise, then they risk not meeting their targets and then getting a adverse audit opinion. So it seems that the system incentivizes them to promise less than they actually intend so that they can over-exceed on all of their targets. And that's unfortunate because ideally we want our departments always stretching themselves to deliver as much as their budget will possibly allow, getting as much bang for their buck as possible. That's the first thing. The second thing is the qualitative assessment of their strategic targets.
Yeah.
So, for example, I could put down, I mean, the AG doesn't do it, and quite rightly so, because I don't think you would ever have the capacity to interrogate each item on the APP and say, well, is that useful for South Africa, or is that in the department's core function?
Mm.
So, you know, it's very easy for the department to say, well, we're going to have 15 meetings this year. And then they submit to the AG the minutes of those 15 meetings and the attendance registers, and there that target is achieved. That APP is achieved, but nothing has been delivered. We've just had 15 meetings. So there's no qualitative assessment of what's behind those APPs and whether the department is delivering on its core mandate. How do we address that?
Yes, a related question, and this has often come up, as there are so many meetings, etc., but what are concrete achievements in this regard? I mean, if one gets within a strat plan under meetings in a particular program, if you like, or sub-program, you know, a percentage of meetings much higher than required, and that is where the funds, the allocation is going, or overseas visits and one thing and another, surely with X amount of money, the committee has to say, well, what will add the best value here with the same amount of money? Is it how many essential meetings are required, etc.? So I think that there has to be some balance here. Yes, you need certain meetings, but what is the balance of expenditure here that would be acceptable, per se? The other issue when it comes to the measurable, you know, indicators and so on, if you look at trade, for example, which is something you mentioned, you could say, well, you know, the trade figures last year were X, and with X and now with less money being available, they've achieved more. Does that mean the department has achieved its targets? Is its sole target to raise increased trade here? What is the actual target itself? So I think targets themselves we need to look at to see just how they can be stretched within themselves. On the issue of underperformance and the incentives, I don't see that really being the case, because we've had just the opposite effect. You could argue we've had 10 years of incentivization for that, and yet the opposite has happened. They either can't see that incentive, just can't see it, or despite that incentive, they're not achieving targets. Do you see? Because nowhere do you see them actually always meeting. If you were to do an examination of all of these reports and strat plans, you would see that the so-called incentive has not led to an under, a performance target, as it were. Otherwise, you wouldn't get the problems you are getting. The other thing are the systems that you referred to, and the, you know, how essential it is to have this audit committee in place, etc., and the linkage between the operational, or rather the strategic allocation of funds within the department itself, and then that allocation in relation to the operational expenditure, finally, and that linked to the targets, which should, of course, have all been informed by the policy, the priority policy objectives. And there used to be, in the first 5 years, or in the sixth year, just after the first 5 years, the whole emphasis moved to core business in government departments, core business. That seems to have shifted somewhat. Now, is this shift because it doesn't matter any longer, because we're not going to have a silo approach, and we're going to have an integrated interministerial approach to matters? So it doesn't matter where it's being delivered, as long as they all get together and synergize the delivery. IPAP, for example. Is this working this way? How do you account for it? How can it be accounted, you see? So I'm just asking you to assist us there, because DTI, more than any department, faces those particular challenges. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, members. It's indeed very relevant questions. I'll start with the last one, and it's in fact a very difficult question. And the only guidance I can give is that one should look at, if there's legislation, what is the requirements of the legislation, because you mentioned, Honourable Chairperson, core business, moving away from core business. One should be careful if there's legislation which is still valid and not been withdrawn, an entity cannot move away from that legislative mandate. And that is why I said, as part of oversight, when you look at what is in the strategic plan, and it's an entity that is guided by legislation, or that's been established in terms of legislation, you should, as part of oversight, ensure that they still stay within that legal mandate, because otherwise they will not be complying with the legislation. Then some of the what changed in our environment is for instance, the 12 outcomes. And that is why I'm suggesting that when an entity presents its plan, that you should consider to ask them to draw the link for you between which of the 12 outcomes is relevant to them, and how did they include those outcomes, or how do they contribute towards those outcomes. That is the best suggestion I can make in terms of of getting to as close as possible to what an entity should be doing in the current environment. Cannot lose sight of legislation if there is. Then, of course, one of the big indicators is then the 12 national outcomes. Then, I think one should ask an entity to link the budget to the strategic plan, because you cannot look at the two in isolation, you know. And I think they need to do a presentation on how does our budget now actually talk to our indicators. You sometimes get entities that, if you look at their budget structure, a large percentage of the budget will actually go into what we call administration, salaries and the rent of the building, and then there's 20% left for actually executing the mandate, you know. And then you would tend to find that they will have difficulty in achieving the actual set of objectives. The Honourable Member here asked a question about, wouldn't entities tend to set their targets low to achieve? It's a difficult one, because the chairperson raised it from a different perspective. So we tend to see two scenarios literally, that there might be some entities going in low, and there might be others continuously too high and also not achieving. To get to the right answer is going to be difficult, but I think the exercise that one should do is that the oversight committees and the ministers should use their experience to try and determine what is reasonable in this environment. And like I say, the best suggestion I can make is if you look at with hindsight, look at what happened to the budget. Look at the percentage of them achieved. Look at which ones have been achieved. You mentioned the example of having 12 meetings. So if all the achievements that have been met is the ones with the 12 meetings and those which I tend to call maybe the softer ones, you know, have the real big ones been achieved? And if they haven't been achieved and all the money has been spent, then there's some misalignment there that needs to be looked at. So there's no formula that can help one to say, you know, this is exactly where the target should be set. But from an oversight point of view, I think that interrogation to actually make sure it's not set too high and not set too low. It should be set at the realistic at the realistic level. I think what is important is that would help a bit, because you also mentioned the nature of some of these targets. Some of them is purely having meetings, you know, and there's a requirement that for all these objectives there should be technical indicators. And I think what you should consider to do is to ask the entities to actually take you in a bit more detail through the technical indicators, so that you can, as an oversight committee, get a good understanding what is behind that specific objective. In detail, how is it that they're going to measure it and going to measure the achievement against that? And that one should ask the question. Sometimes maybe it's relevant to say we should measure the 12 meetings. But maybe sometimes the 12 meetings is just a mechanism to get to something else that you should actually be measuring. And one should interrogate those measures a bit. So I would really suggest that you ask your entities just to take you through the technical indicators so that you've got a bit better understanding. I cannot overemphasize the importance of the budgets and the link between the budgets and these strategic plans. Then lastly, yeah, the findings, and that's why I started off by saying I think at this point in time a helpful tool will be what is in this book. It will at a glance tell you which were our entities which traditionally we had findings on performance information, in what areas were they, was it in usefulness, was it in compliance. This book can help you on that. Then yes, we will now be auditing the 12-13 year. And those results will be available end of, let's say, beginning of August. One would really hope that through the oversight and through our involvement, that entities would have addressed release their action plans, you know, to try and really make significant movement on the area of performance information. If there's anything that I've missed, then I would gladly, please just remind me, and I will gladly reply.
No, we'd like to thank you, Mr. Van Vuren. This is helpful. We would like to see you again, but I would like you to really try and squeeze out about 6 of these books so that I can at least make one available to the DA, to what's the name, to cope, you know, what you call the full-time members, if I may put it that way. And then, of course, the 3 of the Manco, that's 5, and the staff, 1, 7, as an initial exercise, you see. So at least the key players in this area. Whoopsie, yes, don't kill yourself. We each have one. You're busy sort of doing a bit of a, what do they call that, a slinger, catapult.
We see what we can do.
If you can, because I'll tell you why I suggest that we try and prioritize this PC. We actually have the most entities to deal with, as you know. And we really do need to try and get into them. I mean, they've been created all the time, the entities. Thank you very much. Are we happy with that approach? You know, we do appreciate they don't have too many, but thank you very much for being here, both of you. And I notice that I now have your name. It's Mr. Cabello Makitla. Thank you, the manager there. We're basically going to close off with in the next 5 minutes or so, and I'll tell you why. If I could just brief you on the program before us here, in which you had the IPAP, you know, the initial report, as it were. And we spoke about consideration of that. Do you see here? Consideration of the first draft. Now, just so that you're in the picture, thank you very much, Mr. Lawrence.
Thank you.
You will recall that we worked on this at the end of last year, hoping we would, in fact, complete it then, but there were too many loose threads and outstanding issues. And then the suggestion, which was adopted by the committee for a colloquium, which would complete the process in January. We all remember that again. And then that was postponed by the chair of chairs, Mr. Froelich, because there was a conflicting seminar being held by ESCOM, being called up nationally, which involved so many of the players that we had wished to engage. Consequently, our debate, which had been scheduled for the middle of February, as it were, just before the middle, could not take place. So it never did get into the House, this very critical report. We have since extended it with today's input as well. I'm sure all of us are aware of that. And there is a need for us, given that we have not actually taken this to the House, although that had been our intention, to integrate the whole process, which was the initial public hearings per se, the continuation of those public hearings in one sense of the word through a colloquium, very, you know, identified strategic players in this area, and then reach a conclusion and propose certain recommendations in this regard. But you will recall that we started this not because it was the first IPAP or the first this or the first that, but because every year we had interrogated IPAP. And in the first year, it became apparent that there were certain energy and admin issues. And in the second year, it became more apparent. And in the third year, extremely apparent, you know, that this was the case. So even with the subsequent iteration of IPAP, there was this impediment. And today, very clearly put, which I think just underlines the whole issue, is there is a lot of value add that has been done. However, it has constantly been qualified by the cost of the inputs and other factors that contribute to this. I mean, you know, that was very, and this is what we have tried to address, not just say bringing down a price per se, which has happened. And we need to indicate that when once brought to their attention, there was this attempt to do that then by the ports, say, for example, Eskom, the decision which was taken by NERSA rather than Eskom itself, and come to a position that I hope I won't speak out of order, but that I thought most of us did agree with in the committee, needed to be a constructive way forward. That while we welcome, which I'm going through some of the inputs seem to be the case, we welcomed the progress that had been made. We needed even more progress in those particular areas. And what should those recommendations be? So I'd like us during the break, because of course I realize we're not meeting next week at all, but we will get all of the other information, is to study the Hansard, which you would have received by now, I take it. If you haven't, make sure you do get them before you leave this week. And come forward at our first meeting, you know, when we return, with recommendations that are really going to take the whole concept of reindustrialization in South Africa forward, as it were, in the manufacturing sector, and come back with these in writing to the committee, having emailed them through to the secretary, you know, who will give me these. And I make this clear, and I'm going to ask the secretary to please communicate this to all of the parties so that we don't come back and people say, well, we need time now, you know, to look at it. So we need to do that, having studied the Hansard, the first draft, plus the information we received today. We're then going to ask Mr. Hermans and also the researcher, Ms. Madalani and Ms. Hurling, to redraft this with myself into a more integrated document without, you know, obviously it would come back to the committee and you would then scrutinize it, but hopefully you would get this at least a week before. You'll have that opportunity. So when you come back here, paragraph by paragraph, you can comment. I hope we're on the same wavelength.
The only question I have is about the Hansard. You said we should have received the Hansard of what?
Well, you know, we've had public hearings. There were all those Hansards last year. The colloquiums were all Hansards.
I mean, those Hansards are available, I presume. Yes. We haven't received them.
I haven't. That's what I'm also saying. I said that I should have had them by Monday, and you assured me I would.
You haven't
seen them. So I still haven't seen them. I want them before the end of today with everyone. I don't want members now saying to me tomorrow, we still don't have them. Because we're giving them a job to do. Because, you know, for us now to say the first consideration, you know, on a draft which I've already said hasn't captured, you know, what we needed to capture completely. But I don't want to create the impression that all these facts are wrong, because that is not the case at all, you know. So, but I want us really to scrutinize the document, because this is, alongside trade, our core oversight. And we need to really give it our full attention. And certainly on that particular note, I want to close off the item called consideration of the first draft. Are we happy with that one? Right. Now, as we come really now at the end...
Sorry, one last question, Chair. Yes. Who shall we send recommendations to you or to the Secretary?
No, I'm suggesting let the Secretary coordinate everything, and then I want all of the comments as they're coming in every, say, twice a week or something along those lines, so we can move, and then I will also arrange a meeting with staff so we can get this, you know, flapped into the shape we want it to, so that you get what would be called a second draft. I mean, are we all on board with that?
Yeah.
Right? Now, with respect to other matters, I handed out invitations to people which came via DTI, right, on Friday. The problem was already when I booked last week and I booked to go home, not realizing we'd only finish at something like 5 o'clock tomorrow with the human rights and one thing and another, very critical issue, that, and I booked a 6 o'clock flight, you know, at night, 1800. I can't see myself even getting to an airport by that. So I certainly will remain in Cape Town for the Human Rights Day, per se, and then book a flight out. But Mr. Hermans contacted me already on Monday, because I was here Monday for SAEU, and reported that he's been trying since the Thursday, basically, to get the tickets, when I first got the invitation, you see, on Wednesday, and I spoke to him then Thursday morning. There aren't flights. There haven't been flights. The first flight you can get out is 6:45, and that was Tuesday or Monday. Today, even those flights are full. Do you know?
The world has gone mad. You can't get on a plane to Joburg or Cape Town.
Well, the problem is a simple one. The flight to KZN was stopped. I'm looking at Honourable Kwabasa. Mm-hmm. And so all of the KZN people, whether it's Parliament or whoever, fly to Johannesburg and then KZN. And that has really put a tremendous pressure on flights. And secondly, that came after the closure of one time, is it, and a couple of other airlines. So, you know, things were already quite full. And then that, and as you know yourself, when we need to get back and it's after the presidential what and a holiday, it's always been full at the best of times. Unless you book two, you know, a week or two before. And now, of course, there's not a hope in hell. There isn't any hope. I really wanted you to go, but it's not possible, unfortunately. With respect to the BRICS, I have even again this morning tried to approach Durko directly to try and give us a few more tickets. But as you know, we didn't organize this. Durko did with the departments. And each department was given X, you know, number of tickets. And it's as simple as that. And I know you even tried. And I must make it very clear, and I may be sorry the Honorable Ambrosini's not here. There's been an emphasis that we follow the rules of Parliament, and which is what we are doing. And the rules make it very, very clear. It is a proportional, all these issues, such as study visits, over, you know, all of this. And it happens this way. ANCX number, DAX number, after that, COPE. And those are the facts. It's not a question of excluding on personalities or anything. We are pursuing the rules of Parliament, as requested by a number of members of Parliament. So that is most unfortunate. I do want, as members know, to get more people to go. So I will continue to try and report back tomorrow. I hope, because I know you are regular, in the regular attendance, and we would like to get a couple more tickets. Yes, Honourable Hildur.
Thank you very much for your efforts, Chair. I know you've tried your best. I just want to say, more generally on DTI invitations, it would have been great for us to be able to attend this thing tomorrow night. And of course, if we had received the invitation earlier, there would have been flights available. Mm. Now that we received it so late, there are no flights available. But I remember it was either in January or February, it was this year, there was an intellectual property conference that happened in Joburg, which we received the invitation, I think, about 4 days before the conference happened. And again, with our parliamentary schedules, it's not possible to amend a whole diary 3 or 4 days in advance. So again, it would have been fascinating to attend that intellectual property conference. I was not able to attend. We need to have a word with the departments about getting these invitations to us sooner so that we can make the necessary amendments, chat to our chief whips, make sure we can be out of Cape Town so so that we can be there?
I won't formally approach the DTI. Sometimes they get invitations through another party, and that is the problem. You know, that they aren't directly DTI issuing them in the first place. However, this one was, and but it is unfortunate, as I say, even last week the flight was full, per se. But I do want to thank members for their interest, and I do apologize for missing a critical part of the meeting earlier on. And we'll see you tomorrow. We are meeting at 9 tomorrow. It is a very full schedule as well. 9 o'clock. Where are we meeting? The old assembly chamber. And I'd ask members to all try and be there. Thank you very much.